This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We're going to get to a number of topics before we get to our guest at the bottom of the hour about North Korea. Seems like the country has been debating the North Korea dilemma for how long? 20, 30 years? And we certainly had what many people believe is a game-changing event with the missile that was took place. When did it take place? It was late. It was Monday night our time.
Yeah, into Tuesday morning.
Into Tuesday, right?
But it was clearly they were trying to tie it to the 4th of July.
They were trying to tie the 4th, and then there's still some subjective debate how you would label it, the way all the technology that's needed to firmly have it to say 100% that if it was launched in a different angle, it could get to Alaska. But there's great concern that this moved it to a different level. So a very good guest on that topic at the bottom of the hour. Other topics before then, including Apple. Apple is their masters at so many things tied to the iPhone, including these supposed leaks and how they happen. It seems like they happen the same way all the time, Dan. Somebody just by happenstance leaves it somewhere where some outlet that's always trying to come up with the definitive story about the next iPhone or the next laptop or the watch, you name it. And so now there's just an amazing amount of anticipation for the iPhone 8, that this was tied to 10 years after the iPhone, which was a couple weeks ago. And feeling like that they haven't had a major change in a long time and that they need that. And certainly if you look at the market, how people are betting and changing and pushing up the stock price, many smart people are counting on the iPhone 8 to be incredibly popular. One of the latest things that's come out, Dan, is the idea that now with this iPhone that you wouldn't need the code. You wouldn't need the thumbprint anymore. It would just be the face scanner, okay? You would come over. As soon as it recognized you, boom, it opens up. Now, in this story, they say that the Samsung Galaxy S8, that people have had a tough time with that and that they're struggling with this, but they absolutely want to make this a part of the next one. Whether it's the iPhone 8 or it's other smartphones that everybody wants to use. How important do we think that is for the next technology for us to say, I have to get that, I want that, that the thumbprint's not enough, I don't want to do the code, I just want to be able to pick it up, it recognizes face recognition, and boom. Because to me, it's fine. I'm more intrigued by facial recognition with so many other aspects of where we're going. The phone?
No.
Not much.
I mean, the number of people that are going to run out and buy this phone because of the facial recognition capability is very, very small.
It's non-zero,
but it's very small.
They're the iPhone diehards already.
Right, for the most part.
That love to buy it.
And they're going to want to get it anyway. It doesn't matter.
Yes.
I agree that the industry needs to come up with some sort of new hook, right? I mean, that there needs to be some, but it's not, let's make the stuff that we already can do with the phone easier. It's the phone has to do stuff that it hasn't done before.
And that we haven't thought of, right?
Exactly. That's the kind of innovation that they need to get to if you really want to get people charged up to go out and buy the latest, greatest thing again.
They probably should call us, don't you think?
I mean,
it'd be nice.
I'm available.
Yeah, we are available. Does that, the face scanning, does that appeal to you at all?
Not in the least. I mean, and in fact, it kind of makes me nervous because my sisters and I have pretty similar faces.
You know what really should be concerned? Carter, because we all keep seeing Adam Carter all around town. People think that look like Carter. Let's just have his phone with us when we're walking downtown.
I finally adopted the fingerprint. I had been doing the code for so long. Man, it's so nice.
Have you heard of the internet too? Any other things you're kind of slow to?
Well, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
That's how I look at life.
You know what that tells me? She's been hanging around my father too much. I don't want to change. Let's not move on. You can join us here at WCCO July 11th, next week, for Camden's concert at the Hopkins Center for the Arts, featuring the music of the Wright Brothers. All proceeds go directly for the research of cystic fibrosis. For all the information, call 952-979-1111, or maybe it's easier for you. Go online, camdensconcert.com. If you'd like a pair of tickets for this event next Tuesday, because you're kind enough to listen to us, we'll take the first caller who calls us right now to get a pair of tickets to see good group and benefit a cause that touches too many people. And if anybody within our listening audience can play a small part in helping out, that would be fantastic. So a free pair of tickets, just call in now, 651-989-9226. Okay, this topic has been discussed here and a variety of other shows, but it's coming up again. It's what's happening in various schools and with the law about to change. If the kids go up to the lunch line and they don't have any money, they do not have any money, what should the schools do? The U.S. Agricultural Department is now requiring districts to adopt policies this month for addressing meal debts to foreign parents at the start of the academic year. The agency is not specifically barring most of the embarrassing tactics, such as the cheap sandwiches in place of hot meals, or sending students home with debt reminders, such as hand stamps. We've talked about that nonsense before. But it's encouraging schools to work more closely with the parents to address delinquent accounts and ensure the children don't go hungry. Now, some states are saying, we've got it. New Mexico, in fact, this year became the first to outlaw meal shaming, and several other states are weighing similar laws. Free and reduced price meals funded by the Agriculture's Department National School Lunch Program shields the poorest families. These are families of four, let's say, that earn less than $32,000 a year. But a lot of people are saying it's the group just above it that is facing this situation. So we've had these stories before, Dan. Here in Minnesota, across the country, myriad of ways. We had a couple stories. I think one was in Seattle near the end of last school year, where one father became aware of it with the school district where his, I forget if it's a single child or children, and started raising a lot of money. And it covered, it was tens of thousands of dollars. There are schools that have been harsher. So what do you do? Okay, what do you do when kids are showing up, and how do you deal with this? Number one, for me, you have to realize who's derelict in the payment. It's not the kid. I'm sorry. It's not the fourth grade kid. It's not the seventh grader. So I think you're making the wrong direction of your punishment when you're telling a kid no food. No food can't happen. Okay? It's in these rare circumstances when it's come up in any way, and it's been the reduced meals. But what do you do, Dan, if it's a family and you've alerted them time after time after time? For a long time, when our boys were going to school, we would get a notice if we were low. And you could do it online. Simple. So do you just have to accept that if some parents are just delinquent, you don't do anything about it? Because that's not fair. You have to be reasonable, though, if it's families where they just don't have the money, and the exact punishment should not be, in this case, not handed out to the kids. How do you realistic deal with it when you're trying to do what? You're trying to come up with a policy that is not going to be the case by case, because that's what they always hate. They always hate because they're worried about, okay, why do you have a policy for Dan, but not for Lindsay? So I make you the czar of schools across America. You are now the Secretary of Education. You get to make this decision. What are you doing?
First you recognize two things. One, there is no magic bullet. There is no this, you do this, and then everything's taken care of, right? Because if that was the case, we would have done it by now. There's a lot of very smart people running a lot of the schools in this state and across the country.
Sure.
If there was an easy way to fix this, then we would have come up with it by now. Two, the other thing you have to realize, and you hit on this, and it's the critical point of all, this entire conversation, feed the kids.
Yeah.
You feed the kids.
Yeah, that's
and then figure it out after that. But you feed the kid. Under no circumstances should any school district at any point stop a child and say, no, you don't get to eat today because your funds are depleted.
Think about what we're doing. Kids in line, just having a normal day,
yeah.
has the meal of, let's be honest, mediocre food at almost every school in America. And you now they tell them, no. And then in the rarest circumstance, you take it away. Most of the time it's no. Here's the peanut butter and jelly. Here's the cold ham and cheese.
And I'm not even talking about this on a, you know, emotionally scarring the child level necessarily. Kids got to eat. If you want to figure out some sort of reduced thing or whatever, you know, we can have that discussion. But under no circumstances do you literally pull a meal away from a child like that. Just no, zero, can't do it.
Well, and we've had people who have quit. We've had people who've been fired.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't do it. So how do you then determine? Let's say it's me. Let's say it's me where I can afford it, but I just have been lazy. I've been lazy for months, and I'm not taking literally the 60 seconds it takes to go online, punch in my credit card, and do it. Because
do you think that that's rampant? Do you think isn't the vast majority of this debt due to the fact that people can't afford it, that they're just unable to pay this money?
I think there are examples where we all aren't paying attention to this, okay, and could get behind a meal or two. Now, the individuals who have just decided on their own, I could pay this, but I'm just way behind, I think that is the rarity. But you look at some of these totals. I can Google other totals. It turns out to be a large amount of money.
Yeah, no, I'm not trying to downplay the amount of money that it is. I'm saying that I think when we get into discussions like this, and you can even broaden it out to welfare discussions, that the fact that there are people out there trying to game this system, those folks exist. Don't deny it at all.
Yep.
The this answer to that is not to burn the house down, is not to say, well, no, we're just going to cancel everybody and you're all on your own. I mean, I get the impetus to not want to suborn cheating. I get that. But shouldn't that be the thing that we deal with because we want to make sure kids get a hot meal at school? Let's deal with that. Let's make sure that happens. And if some people are gaming the system, well, we'll work on that later on. But shouldn't the focus be this way around?
Yes. Okay. But then let me go to Lindsay because 100% right. We got to feed the kids. What amount of time then do we put into for the folks who have the ability to pay and are not? And how are we determining that? If it turns out we're at some school and there's 50 kids and they're well behind, how do we have any idea as the school district if their parents have the capability? Now, we're just going to presuppose because I live in Plymouth and that's the YZ school district. Well, if you live in Plymouth, you can pay. That's a lot of generalizing and it's not an automatic, but there's no doubt the first priority has to be get the kids food. Stop embarrassing them. Stop shaming them. It's insulting. And for the kids to have a bet, the number of kids who are showing up at schools who don't have food in the morning, don't have food at lunch, it's nauseating. We got a lot of issues in the country. We can resolve that one because how many times we hear when we do Let's Kick Hunger and other charitable events that the concern is when those kids don't have school, they don't have that area. But how do the schools then deal with the other ones who legitimately can pay for this and aren't, and determining who they are?
Yeah, and my worry on that whole idea is, so what, you send out applications that parents fill out that they turn in a W-2 from the year before or, whatever program we're going on, because most of the time you have to show your income.
For a public school, you don't.
No, I'm not saying for a public school, but I'm saying if you were to apply for a loan or you were to apply for something, you're showing your income.
Right.
So I don't think it's that far-fetched to ask someone to do that. But my worry on the whole thing is...
Yeah. See, I think it is. If a public school is going to reach out to their parents at the start of the year saying, because we've had problems with, parents not paying attention, that we need some documentation of your income?
No, my point was being if the parents want to apply to be you know, on this special plan or to get their children reduced lunches. That way you would then take out the people who are just not paying.
Okay, so all those folks who want to qualify for something where they're in a position financially, you know, that can't pay it, they will be notified. They will. Here's the process.
How we do this. We want to make it fair for the children. We don't want finger pointing.
And so anybody else that didn't go through that paperwork, they then are going to draw the greater scrutiny.
Yeah, because I mean, the whole idea is get the children fed, but at some point, those meals have to be paid for.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
And so, what do you think? Can't count on nonprofits to do that.
What do you think about that idea? That if you're gonna be in this position, yeah. You're in some financial position where you don't know if you can pay for the kids. You do that. So if anything happens during the school year with a different kid, if we look through the file and it says there's nothing in there, then we're gonna start reaching out to the parents. But again, the kids still getting food.
It sounds good in theory. A couple of issues that come to mind are, A, where are we drawing that line? And how arbitrary are we drawing it, right? Because wherever you draw that line, there's going to be folks on the positive side of it that are still going to be in some sort of financial, you know, difficulty at some point. And two, do we worry about the number of people that are willing to say, yes, I need that help,
yeah,
when they absolutely do because they're either embarrassed. Or, you know, I mean, yeah, that's part of it. And how public is that information, and how worried are they that if I apply for this, my name, my whole thing's going to be put out there?
When I was in school, we got calls all the time if our lunch money was negative.
It's just online now. In almost all places.
Really?
Yeah, you get it. Because you're paying online, you get notices, and there are times when the teachers, through email or through whatever set up through the system of school, letting you know. The phone calls are almost all automated at this point, too. 25 past 2 on CCO. Among the texts coming in, why can't we provide free lunches for kids? Can't we be Minnesota nice? I don't think every person who sends their kid to a public school shouldn't have to include that in some of the cost. I mean, there's no ball. We couldn't even ballpark this. But if you just said all the kids who start going to school from kindergarten on, that's just a part of the benefit you get from going to our school. That is a staggering amount of money. That just is. That would change an awful lot of the component on financing. We're already having huge financial issues tied to it.
Well, that's the thing is, I mean, you're paying for it one way or the other, right? It's just a matter of if you're a person who lives in a municipality and you don't have kids, you're also paying for the kids that go to schools in your district, you know, for their lunch, right?
Yeah.
It would be a property tax issue. It would be the same way we fund school any other way. That number would just go up. So, and what you would argue is that by broadening it out over the entire tax base, it actually makes, you know, life cheaper on folks that have kids in school. That's the argument for it.
Yeah, that would, right? No. Because of the number of people live in different cities who don't have kids.
Right.
So would you, philosophically, I'm not eliminating, but if you told me today, do I think once your kid goes to pick the public school, you should know you don't have to pay a penny? Because are we going
to
do...
Well, you don't have to. Are we not paying directly. You're still paying.
I know, but I'm saying, so my responsibility is going to be lessened because other people here, extracurricular activities? I mean, where would we stop? Now, food is a much more essential situation. Yeah. It's different. But, and again, some of schools are crazy now with all their fees. Ludicrous. I just don't know about this. I think there are plenty of families who can pay for this, and they should be more directly on the hook as opposed to diffusing the payments to everybody who lives in that particular area.
I have zero problem with the idea, you know, in theory, because I think, you know, as a society, we can easily afford this. I think when you start doing the math and the number of things that we spend money on, the amount of money that we spend on those things, I don't think it would be that difficult. I think it's a pie in the sky.
That can go a long way on that too, because you're right.
You can, but again, you know, we talk about it too many times on this show, you know, for people to forget.
Yep.
It's that it's not a slippery slope, one situation at a time. Just because you do one thing doesn't mean you have to do another thing. So deal with this, fix this problem, and let's be done with it. I don't think there's any chance in heck that's going to happen.
Right.
Because, I mean, how often do we vote for that kind of tax increase?
Never. Yes or no, do you want it to happen?
Yeah, I'd love it to happen. I think that'd be great.
Lindsay, yes or no? Do you want right now that parents should know once their kids go to public schools, that they're not going to pay a dime. That's just going to be a part of the funding that's going to go for the schools that will be paid mainly through property taxes, compared to now, it's directly, if you and John have kids, you're going to pay for that. And if in a couple of years I don't have kids going to school, I don't have to deal with that. But now it would just be a part of the property taxes and the other assessments that those towns and maybe potentially counties would have to pay.
I have no problem paying for feeding children, but I would want a complete overhaul of the food that we're feeding them. I would, if it comes down to taxpayer money is paying for school food in public schools, then we need to do better at the food that we're giving to them. I just looked up the USDA, the application process that parents would go through if they apply for free and reduced price school meals, which they can do anytime during the year. And they do ask for income, and it's pretty broken down. And each year there's a different guidelines, but it does say that if you don't fall into those guidelines, that you can reach out to the school and that there are programs they can put you on.
A number of people are talking about the free lunches and breakfasts. We've talked about that many times. We're saying that here. There's no denying that. We're just having the conversation about other examples, what we're talking about here. Somebody's saying, what about the automatic pay from checking your credit card? Because most of it now is online. That once you start it, it's just automatically? I don't know about that again. I think that's up to me, Dan, and it should be up to me 100% of the time if I want to do that versus, okay, I've now signed up for this, and this is a much more important issue than 99% of the items we talk about. But when I put my credit card in there, automatically you're just going to charge it as opposed to I'm okaying it or agreeing to that?
Yeah,
I'm not for that.
No, you can't require that.
No. We'll chime in with other texts when we come back, but we'll remind you, we're going to talk about the North Korea story, which is another one that is not going away and has serious implications, short-term, long-term. We have had different presidents and different administrations facing this difficult dilemma. How much did it change off the last 48 hours? A good guest on that topic in minutes. So many different viewpoints for a long, long time about the dilemma involving North Korea, our country and North Korea. North Korea, South Korea, North Korea, China, the effect it'll have on the G20 and the conversations coming up. Melissa Hannum has been covering this story for a long, long time. She is with the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies and knows this topic extraordinarily well, and I appreciate her time here. Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it. So when people look at what took place the last 48 hours— And they have their own life going on, and they pay attention to this, but they're not consuming it. And it seems like every so often, one of the leaders, in this case Kim Jong-un, does something, right, which raises a number of red flags and a lot of concern. But this one in particular, I heard numerous people saying this absolutely changes the game, and this now is a direct threat to part of the country, Alaska. Do you agree with that viewpoint? And if you differ, tell me in what ways you do.
Sure. So North Korea has been working towards an intercontinental ballistic missile, or an ICBM, for some time now. And on July 4th, local time, they tested that missile. This is the first missile that they've ever launched that could exceed the 5,500-kilometer mark, which is what the U.S. intelligence community starts deeming an ICBM. The test data that we have from their launch from U.S., Japan, South Korea indicates that while they shot it almost straight up, almost like a pop fly, and it didn't go that far across the Earth, the range, if you flattened out that curve to a trajectory towards the U.S., would put Alaska in range. I think the even more concerning thing is that we're not sure yet whether they tested that missile at its full range. So today, my colleagues and I are taking measurements of the photographs we have of the missile, and there are certain clues in the photographs that indicate how big each fuel and oxidizer tank in each stage of the missile are. And we have some shots of the engine that will help us as well. And we're hoping to put together an estimate of how large that full range of that missile might be.
When will you have that information?
We're cranking it out.
And when you're analyzing it, how precise can you be? I mean, can you be 100%? Where can you be at when you're analyzing this from afar as opposed to having complete access to what they have when they made this decision to fire the missile?
Well, of course, working from afar is always difficult, but over time, it's never been easier. Anyone with an internet connection can download these photos and analyze them pixel by pixel, and so that's what we do. Oftentimes, North Korea uses photoshopping in its propaganda pieces, so we carefully go through to make sure that none of the images have been altered. And then we use a technique called mensuration, which is the same that the CIA or any other intelligence agency does, where we take certain features in a photograph that we know to be a certain size, and then we use it to measure out objects that we don't know the size of. So in this case, many of the photographs showed the picture of a truck that North Korea illicitly procured from China and put on parade in 2012. And we know the size of that truck because of previous mensuration that we did, and also because that truck actually had its details published on Chinese websites. So we can use that truck to make an accurate estimate of the length of the missile, the diameter of the missile, and then, you know, depending on the welding and the different markings on the outside, we can often see where tanks start and stop. And by knowing the ratio of the fuel to the oxidizer and making an educated guess about what that fuel and oxidizer is, we can get a pretty good range estimate. And our technique in the open source at universities like where I work is probably not too different from what the U.S. intelligence community does, because it's very hard to get insider information on these types of things in North Korea.
So there was some of the analysis, Melissa, talked about the feeling that North Korea was years away from this type of capability, that some people believe, sadly, it was inevitable, but that they didn't think it would be happening in 2017. From all the work that you were doing on this before, did this, from what you know at this point, and I get it, that you're now saying you do a lot of this work, and I think it'd be well worth all of us to pay attention what your final results are, but did this timeline even surprise you?
No, not at all. I mean, I think that it's convenient and comforting to think of North Korea as a backwards country, and in many ways it is. But, you know, the areas where they choose to be backwards, you know, that famous picture of North Korea from space at night with, you know, almost no lights on, it's not because, you know, they're choosing to be backwards. They're redirecting that energy towards their military programs. And this is the highest priority for them. So a lot of the sort of, you know, Facebook memes and things we see about Kim Jong-un, while they can be funny, they are deeply underestimating both his capability and his desire to make these weapons. One high-level defector from the North Korean embassy in London, Tae Young-ho, told us back in March that Kim Jong-un was planning to have an ICBM launch this year or in early 2018, and it seems like he's made his schedule. And all of last year, they showed us photographs of their engine tests, of the tests of the heat shield that would go on the nose cone to protect it coming through the atmosphere. And so it really shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that they've reached this point. Unfortunately, now that they have reached this point, we have a lot more difficult
alternatives
ahead of us.
How to respond. Okay, so let's deal with that. Someone who clearly is not underestimating this is the Defense Secretary. When presented with options on if the United States and its allies somehow offered up airstrikes, even in a limited way towards North Korea, the response would not be limited. Mm-hmm. And the Defense Secretary recently said, talking about this, that the North Korea response would probably be the worst kind of fighting in most people's lifetimes. Knowing that, knowing how difficult this is, knowing how difficult it would be to put together some sort of coalition, knowing that Let's go as far back as the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, the Obama administration. They've all been trying to do this. They've all tried threats at times. They've all hinted at military intervention. They've all hinted at times, let's have negotiations. And it's had, never has it had the desired effect. Of these alternatives that are proposed going forward, do any of them seem appealing at all?
I think you captured the scenario very accurately. There's really three options, right? There's negotiate diplomatically, and we haven't had a huge, a great track record of doing that. There's do nothing, which is in many ways kind of the strategic patience that we saw. And there is military intervention, which just as you said, and I agree 100% with Mattis that, there is no such thing as limited war in North Korea. You can't, even though, U.S. forces exercise decapitation, regime, a lot of people ask, why can't we just kill Kim Jong-un like I saw in the movies?
Yeah, right.
This is a very centralized state, and North Korea knows that it's got to use everything it's got at once or lose it. And I think, people forget how close Seoul is to the border with North Korea. So even if we put aside all of their ballistic missiles, all of their WMD, and just think about conventional artillery shelling, there would be enormous loss of life and economic damage to Seoul, which is the capital of South Korea, and that's where over 10 million people live. So that's the reason that's never really been an option for the military. And, we hear people talking about it more in academic circles, unfortunately, like where I am. But I think a lot of smart people recognize the consequences of war. I tend to fall into the camp of the least bad option being negotiation. And unfortunately, I think we have to have some really painful discussions amongst ourselves and with our allies, because waiting for North Korea to come to us has only allowed them to make more and more technological advancements. So we do need to engage. We need to do it with eyes wide open and think that cheating may be part of this. But, I think we also have to decide that our goal of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula, that may no longer be an option. Right now, I think probably the best deal we could get would be to limit tests of missiles and nuclear weapons, and maybe a freeze on the production of fissile material. What do they get in return? Exactly. So, so far, the price for that has been too high for the U.S. or South Korea or Japan to accept. What they want is for U.S. and South Korea to stop their joint exercises. I don't know if most Americans realize, but U.S. and South Korea do these joint exercises about twice a year, if not more, and they last for weeks. And they're simulating for a war with Korea. And it's important to keep forces, the readiness level high, but they are very antagonistic to North Korea. So that's one of the things that they want. And this is one of the proposals that Russia and China are pushing right now. Although Russia and China have their own interests in the region, particularly the removal of THAAD, which is the ballistic missile defense program that the U.S. has put in South Korea. Another thing that North Korea wants is recognition. They want to be recognized as a nuclear weapons state, as a legitimate regime. They want to have diplomatic relations. They want sanctions relief. All of these things are really, really distasteful, not the least of which because North Korea has a reprehensible regime with terrible human rights violations and is known as a kind of a cheater on deals in the past. So even if we could make some kind of arrangement, we'd have to implement a really vigorous and intrusive verification regime to make sure they're not cheating. So intrusive that it would make the Iran deal blush, basically. Yeah. And so there's a big gap between all the positions right now.
Okay, let me circle back to what you just said about the other countries on China in particular. Remind folks, Melissa Hannum is with us. senior research associate. In specific, we're talking about North Korea topic. You can tell she knows cold. She's with the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. The president, who was highly critical on the campaign trail towards China, then embraced the leadership, embraced parts of China and the role they could play with North Korea. And then even the last 24 hours has been critical of China. We gave him a chance, talking about trade between the two. Why would China, if solely for their own interests, not for just the greater safety of the rest of the globe, but for their own interests, why would they put extraordinary pressure on Kim Jong-un? Where is their upside?
Okay. So, I mean, China obviously has a slightly different set of goals than the U.S. does. To them, you know, the two worst, they're sandwiched between two terrible options as well. One, they don't want the U.S. to start a unilateral war. Officially, you know, during the time of the Korean War, China was North Korea's ally. And I don't know that they would come to North Korea's aid this time round. The relationship between China and North Korea has really frayed. Most Chinese officials have way more in common, both culturally and trade-wise, with South Koreans than they do with North Korea. And they often view North Korea as sort of an ungrateful vassal state that didn't take their advice or aid. And North Korea is pretty unpopular amongst average Chinese. But that being said, they also don't want the collapse of the North Korean state, because North Korea has a border on China with China, as well as South Korea, and even a small one with Russia. And the collapse of the state would mean a huge influx of refugees, and not just refugees, but refugees who have suffered under one of the worst, you know, if not the worst regimes ever in history. Plague still exists in plague still exists in North Korea. And receiving that kind of influx of refugees is definitely not in China's interest either. So they're trying to walk this fine line between having the U.S. just give up and increasingly become militaristic in the region, and having the South Korean state collapse. They much prefer a kind of status quo. But I disagree with a lot of Trump's statements, and I definitely disagree with the style in which he's handling this particular situation. But there is evidence to say that China has been very bad at enforcing the sanctions that they've put in place. So it's one thing to say you're going to sanction another country. It's another thing to enforce those sanctions. And even though they've, agreed in the UN Security Council to abide by certain sanctions, there are still indications in trade data and in satellite imagery that trade and, for example, coal is still happening.
So let me get to one last point here with about 90 seconds to go. When you look back at how long this back and forth has been taking place, is it fair to be critical, if you want to zero in on the Clinton administration or the Bush administration or even the Obama administration, that they should have been more forceful at that particular time, that the difficult dilemma they faced isn't close to the difficult dilemma that Donald Trump is facing, or is that too convenient? Is that not giving realistic due to how extraordinarily difficult it was for all of those administrations before the challenges this administration is facing right now?
I think you can definitely say that the relationship with North Korea and the rise in its technological capabilities has increased ever since the Clinton administration. I would not blame the Clinton administration, nor the Bush administration, nor the Obama administration for any one action, but the sort of lack of action over time has allowed this to become a worse and worse problem. So I'm over mincing my words, but yeah, Trump is dealing with probably the worst deck of cards of any of the administrations at this point.
Melissa, extraordinarily important topic. You were very good with us. We appreciate it. Guarantee we'll reach out to you again.
Okay, take care. Thanks for having me on.
Melissa Hannum, she again is with the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation studies. It's a 52 past 2. That's your Lindus Construction Time Check. Time to install the last roof you'll ever need with GAF asphalt shingles. Let me tell you about Harry's. A razor I used today, a razor I will use tomorrow. It's a razor I've been using since early last year, and a lot of people are making the change. A lot of people look at this. In fact, there was a long story on what in the Boston Globe a couple weeks ago about the razor wars, because companies such as Harry's are having success as opposed to one company, which was putting out a good product. Nobody's saying it was a lousy razor, but it was really the one dominating. So why can't some other companies take a chance and go after them? And if you have two smart guys, like the guys behind Harry's, you find this great factory where you produce these tremendous razors, and you get it done with Harry's. I have been on board, and I will be. If they stop advertising here, they come to their senses and say, you know, enough of the guy in the afternoon, I'm still on board. They believe in their product so much that they have the free trial set. You're just paying a couple bucks for shipping. It includes the great handle. Then the razor itself is the five precision engineered blades with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, the rich lathering shave gel, the travel blade cover, and the post-shave ball. Again, normally about 20 bucks free. You just pay shipping. Harry's.com and at checkout, use my last name, Hartman. Okay, so yesterday, NPR jumps on, and through Twitter, they kept tweeting out the Declaration of Independence. And apparently some folks who happen to be backers of the president were a bit confused. They thought that when they were tweeting out that this was somehow direct or indirect criticism of the president, and kind of missed the point. I'm assuming at the start they declared what they were doing, or did they just come out with this and said, it's up to you to know what's going on, Lindsay? That part of the story I didn't see, but it kind of just shows where we're at right now and the craziness that literally the Declaration of Independence is turning into, you're attacking our guy, so we better jump in. We are done for the afternoon. I think Maxie is coming up next here on CCO.
The deadline for contract negotiations between Children's Minnesota and Blue Cross Blue Shield is passed without an agreement. Details coming up at 3:03 on WCCO and KMMB FM HD2 Minneapolis, St. Paul.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.